Blog Talk Radio.
I am here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, great. Great. Well, I've got some beeping going on. There we go. Thank you for joining the show today. And let's dive right in. Tell me a little bit about your film, In the Footsteps of Willie Sutton.
Well, Willie Sutton, In the Footsteps of Willie Sutton is a documentary film about a famous bank robber from the 20th century. He started in the 1920s and worked his way in and out of prisons and in and out of banks through early 1950s. And there's never been any real documentary about Willie Sutton, nor has there been a narrative feature film. No one's really chronicalized his life on film until I took the opportunity to do so.
Now, what inspired you to do this?
Well, I was writing screenplays, and for a narrative film based on true stories. And I have always had a passion and interest in true crime stories, and I think the public, everybody loves a good gangster story. So I was writing a screenplay. I did it on an old-time, actually not that old, from the 1960s and early 70s, a mobster named Joey Gallo. And after I finished that screenplay, I just said, okay, let me do something else. And I wanted to try to do something on a character that no one's really covered before. And in my research on Joey Gallo, I found that when he was in Attica State Prison, he became friendly with Willie Sutton. And it clicked, and hey, there's a name I remember of him. And he was this famous bank robber. And I started doing research, and I wrote a screenplay called The Gentleman Bandit. In my research on Willie Sutton, that's what I really enjoy doing, is just learning about the subject. And I found all this material, and I just looked on the desk in front of me. I said, wow, I have enough material here to do a documentary film. No one's ever done anything about Willie Sutton, and it's such an interesting story. So that's what led me to do a film on Willie.
You talk about research, and you did a lot of extensive research. Tell us a little bit how in-depth you got with your research.
Well, first off, it's difficult when you're going back to someone who operated in an era where there aren't really too many individuals to give you firsthand stories on the subject. And Willie Sutton, he passed away in 1980, and getting material a lot, because he was in prison, because there's some police files you could find, FBI, he was on the first top FBI list when they first started in the early 1950s. He was number 11 in the FBI wanted list, and I was able to get a lot of law enforcement material on him, a lot of family background on him, information about from newspapers on his robberies, how they were covered, and since there was some times where he was actually front page news, there was a lot of material from the New York newspapers, Philadelphia newspapers, and even going as far in the Philadelphia Municipal Archives, where they had its public records. A lot of people don't realize that. You could just go to a courthouse, and if the records are available, you could do the research. And they were in the Municipal Archives in Philadelphia. It was just amazing. I mean, they brought up this box of records, and it looked like no one's really looked into this box in over 70 years. And
wow.
It was a wealth of information. It's just amazing what you could get. Mugshots, photographs, other photographs, court transcripts, and it was just a really great source of information.
And did you have to pay a fee for that, or did they just let you come in and
No,
look
no,
at
that's
it? Really?
As a taxpaying citizen, that's one of the one of our privileges we have on records as they're available to the public. That's what the government does for us, and as a researcher, you have that at your disposal.
Wow. Now, how did you get some of the other pictures? Was it all from that type of material, or did you go online and find things as well to put into the movie?
There are the services that licensing of copyright material. The Daily News was the best source of photographs because they really covered the Willie Sutton trial, a lot of different events in Willie Sutton's life. And I went to them. They had an entire mini library on various photographs. So Willie Sutton, they went to their file on Willie Sutton, and I licensed the material from sources like the Daily News, Associated Press, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and some local libraries also that had material.
Mm-hmm.
And
tell us a little bit
about
as
a note, as a film, for a filmmaker, licensing of copyright material is probably one of the biggest expenses.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about how the process is for that.
Well, it's difficult, if you're financing your own film. You really want to keep the expenses down unless you have an unlimited bankroll. But one of the tricks that I learned was that when you're purchasing the license for copyright material, there's different forms of licensing. For full licensing of, say, stock footage, and it might cost, let's just say as an example, $60 per second. So that's a big expense.
Yeah.
For a second, 10 seconds of material of stock footage, it's $600.
Wow.
So, and you're going to use for, especially if it's if you have old newsreel footage, which is crucial to a topic like this, you want to use it. It's very, very valuable to the project. But what you could do is you could buy a limited license where for film festival usage, not-for-profit, educational purposes, it could cost a lot less. It could cost maybe, I was getting as low as maybe $15 per second, which still it's a big expense when you're using a lot of footage, but it does help cut down on your cost. And in the contract you have with the houses that are licensing to you, they will put a agreed-upon price when you want to upgrade to the full licensing. And you'll upgrade to the full licensing when you have an agreement where someone wants to purchase the film from you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you'll need in order for the legal aspect of the project.
Now, how did you go about getting your budget for this? Was it all out of your own pocket?
98% out of my own pocket, yeah.
Wow.
What happened was, I'm not a traditional, what you would consider a traditional filmmaker who came out of through the film school ranks. And it's been told to me that the mantra of film school students is never finance your own project. Go with other people's money. And to me, I just can't do that. It's I believe you have to put your money where your mouth is.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's nice when you could get people to contribute money to the project, it's you're really, especially your first film project, you're not going to make much. You're not going to make any money on it. Probably
uh-huh.
It's a losing proposition in most cases. I guess you could ask anyone that's attempted this. Yeah, right. It's a very rare case where someone comes right out of the starting gate and makes a profit. So, going to investors saying, hey, would you like to invest in my project? It's not an investment. It's a contribution.
right.
And when I first undertook this project, I had a few people that said, hey, I'll kick in a few dollars for you. And I said, well, hold back a second. Let me get it started. I have my own money to start with it. As I go along, if I see it's getting some momentum where there's some possibility that it might go somewhere, great. And it got to that point after I was maybe 75% done with the project, I said, wow, you know what? I'm very happy with the outcome, how it's coming along, and I could use a few more dollars. So I had a couple of friends who contributed a few dollars towards it to help, and that did help. And also, you know, it's also the understanding, okay, if this hits and I have any subsequent projects, you're the first people that I'll bring into it as well if it's something that can make a profit. But they understood. They were just basically helping out, and they weren't looking to make a profit on this particular thing. It's just they wanted to be part of it and were being kind and helpful to me.
Mm-hmm. Besides the footage, you also had music and narration. And tell us a little bit about some of the other aspects of putting this together.
Well, putting together, the first thing, you do your principal photography, you film your interviews, you piece it together and you structure it in a written script of how you want to put it together. And then narration, you script it, and then you get, you do the narration. And then you want to get some background music to it. So I was looking for some form of period music on that. You could use, again, here, and this is another expense, you could license period music. But, again, that's expensive because now, let's say, for example, let's just fast forward today. If I wanted to use, say, a Michael Jackson song for a movie or a Beatles song for a movie, you have two licenses you have to purchase, and it could be in the high six figures to license parts of a song. It's very expensive. So with that, I have a friend who is a musician, and he sent me a disc of some of his some of the things he was working on, and there was this one little bit he had there that sounded great. It really had a nice 1920s sort of roaring 20s type of beat to it, and I he allowed me to use that with the understanding, okay, great, this thing sells, you're in, and he gets credit, and also the understanding that I'll include him in future projects. So he was kind enough to sort of donate his work for the project.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there a lot that you had to cut out once you put everything together, cut it down?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the editing was a lengthy process, a lot longer than I thought it would take. And there was a lot that was cut out. I wanted to keep it to roughly a one-hour film, and I think we were able to cover a lot of the key points, and I think it flowed well. It flows well. It tells the story. It's good, I think, at telling the story of Willie Sutton, and it tells the story in pictures. So I was pretty happy with the outcome. The interviews were very, very crucial to the project. I was fortunate. One of the key values was finding Donald Shea, who was one of the three arresting New York City police officers that slapped the cuffs on Willie Sutton back in 1952. Mm-hmm. I was able to find a couple of attorneys that represented Willie Sutton. His granddaughter we found. Mm-hmm. So there were some very good, I think the interviewees, being able to have someone who actually interacted with this individual was very, added quite a bit of value to the film.
How difficult was it to find them? What was the process of finding these people?
Detective work, really. First of all, Willie Sutton, he authored two books, and really getting into his head, you had to read his books, both books, a couple of times, at least twice, and see, in one of the books were written within, one was written in 1953-ish when he was arrested, and then one was written in the mid-1970s after he was released from prison. And there were a lot of contradicting points in both books. Willie Sutton, he did sort of exaggerate a lot of things, to put it mildly. and there was also, in 1953, he was a bit more careful not to reveal too many things about too many people that were still alive at the time, where in the 1970s, even though a lot was not really as fresh on his mind as it was back over 20 years earlier, he was able to reveal a little more because a lot of the people were no longer with us. So he felt a little more at ease to sort of give up more information. But with that, with the hints that he gave in his book, I was able to sort of identify people. Finding the police officers, I looked up the file and found the names of the three arresting officers and found only one was still living. And with the power of the internet, I was able to locate the individual, and he was just very happy. I said, sure, I'll be happy to sit for an interview.
Was there any
the FBI was very helpful.
Go ahead.
And one of the things, he was very protective about revealing the identity of his daughter, his only daughter. And through my own investigating, I was able to find out who she was, and she's deceased, but I was able to find that she had a daughter, and that was Willie's granddaughter, who actually interacted with her grandfather for quite a while, and she was very helpful and a big part of this project.
Were there any people that you came across that did not want to speak with you?
There were a couple of individuals that were sort of relatives of his accomplices. One individual I was able to track down I didn't return my call, so I realized, okay, this is someone who just doesn't want to, so I respected the privacy there. Another individual was another relative of a different accomplice, and she was very kind of, at first she was interested, then she was reluctant, and then it was it was more like, okay, what's in it for me? I can't, there's nearly nothing. This is just an independent film. It's just a fun project for me at this point. It's not going to be, it's not a big-time film, so I can't really offer you anything.
Wow.
And that was basically it. But most people were very thrilled to talk about their experiences with Willie Sutton or knowledge of Willie Sutton. And you find a lot of people just like reminiscing about a key historical events, even if they're criminally related.
What was so fascinating about him as a character? What makes him really unique as a criminal? Because there's a lot of things, but give me a few.
Well, you know, you're talking about an era where bank robberies were rampant. You had your Don Dillingers, your Bonnie and Clydes, your Babyface Nelsons, and all these people that we've seen covered in film coming into banks, shooting the place up, pulling their guns, and here is Willie Sutton. He never fired his gun.
Mm-hmm.
He basically used his wits to pull a bank robbery. What he did was he studied the bank's procedures, and his routine was he would go out and get a messenger's uniform or a policeman's uniform, pose as one of these types of individuals, knock on the door of the bank before it opened, get himself let in, and then his accomplice would follow him. They'd wait for each employee to come in, wait for the manager to come in, get the manager to open the vault, and then walk out of there with the money before the bank opened to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a clever bank robber.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't have to resort to any real violence. There was the threat of violence, but he never really had to follow through with it because he psychologically disarmed his victims in the bank, and that was and that worked well for him.
And he had some elaborate.
So that's what
kind of
made him, I guess. I'm sorry, what was that?
And to talk a little bit about his escapes as well.
That was the other. He was clever. He escaped. He escaped from three maximum security prisons, and each of his escapes were very well planned, and we cover that well in the film. I personally found his third escape to be pretty amusing. They were all amusing in their own ways. The third escape was his final escape, where he was a fugitive for 5 years, was from Holmesburg Prison, where they were able to get out of their cells, himself and four others. They managed to hold the guards hostage, put on the guards' uniforms, walk over to the prison wall, and then when the tower guards put the beam on them, they just looked up, there they are in uniforms, and said, "Hey, it's only us, we just have some repairs to do," and they climbed over the wall, hopped in a milk truck, and out they were. Which I thought was just amusing. You have to laugh at something like that. The second escape is the one he's most known for is because Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia is now a historical tourist attraction,
mm-hmm.
and he escaped from there with 12 inmates that. A few of them worked on a tunnel for close to a year. And one morning, on their way to breakfast, they just managed to go into the cell where there was this entrance to the tunnel, and they all just piled through this tunnel one at a time, 12 of them got through. And they all managed to get caught within a short period of time. And ironically, Willie was one of the first ones to get captured.
Mm-hmm.
But they made it through. It's in the film, and people could also read about it, and there's articles on it. It's a fun thing to go to take the tour at the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. But the tunnel they really worked on, they were able to hook up into the electricity. They dug a side tunnel where they were able to discard the dirt that they were digging into the sewer system. It was just a marvel how they did that. It was just amazing. And the fact that here they are, they pop out of this hole on the outside of the street outside the wall of the prison, and there they are, they get caught within no time. It was just, oh. They spent close to a year, too close to a year planning this break, and what happened?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. What do you think was the most surprising thing that you found out about him? that you didn't know.
I got to think about that. There was a lot really that surprised me about him. I think the prison breaks were probably the most surprising.
Certainly the most entertaining.
They're very entertaining, and just you know how he pulled it off. It was just he was patient. He was a you know you have your. He certainly wasn't the type of guy that was going to run in, put a ski mask on, and pull a gun and hold up a local liquor store. Everything he planned everything really well. The final robbery that he's known for, it was a bank in Woodside, Queens, New York, and he spent a couple of weeks just watching the bank, watching the procedure of the employees, and that's how he planned things. He just mapped things out. He was very careful, and I guess you could say it worked for him because he never was caught during a robbery. He was never caught fleeing from a robbery, and his captures when he got arrested were usually just by something careless of one of his accomplices or just a fluke, which was the case in his final arrest in 1952, where he was spotted riding on this New York City subway.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you did these interviews with people, did you travel to meet with them, or did you do it over the phone?
I did,
or
yes.
I know some of them were in the film. So.
Yeah, I
okay.
did travel. There was one subject was in Denver, one was in Texas, a couple in Philadelphia, and I did make it a point to go to all three of the prisons that he escaped from.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern State, which is a tourist site right now, Holmesburg Prison, where I needed to get permission from the Prison Bureau. It's no longer an operating prison, but they were able to give me a tour, and we did walk through from their notes and from my information steps that Willie Sutton and his crew they took during their escape. And then the first prison he escaped from was Sing Sing, which is still a maximum security prison, state prison, upstate New York, and that is an operating prison and was able to be escorted around there where we interviewed a prison historian there talking about Willie Sutton's escape. I mean, the individual was not working at the prison at the time. Sutton made his escape in 1932, but he was able to, he had all the records and information on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did it take you to put this together from the beginning of the research through the end of the editing process?
Well, since I already had a lot of the research done from writing the screenplay, when I decided, okay, when I went into documentary film mode, I would say probably 9 to 10 months.
Wow.
Yeah, 9 to 10 months. And that was only because I didn't really have one dedicated person working with me on only this. I had a couple of people working on this for hire, and they were also working on other projects, so I wasn't able to sort of harness all their time for this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also another thing, really, is, you know, for... When working on a film, especially for an independent filmmaker working on a documentary, one of the most important ingredients I find is really you need to be passionate about the subject.
Yeah.
And, you know, I develop my own projects, and by doing so, I'm working on subjects that I'm interested in, true crime being a subject I'm very fascinated with. I mean, if I'm hiring someone that's, sort of really passionate about, say, environmental issues, that's their specialty, as a sort of a camera person or an editor, and I'm saying, okay, great, hey, want to work with me on a crime film? If, you know, if they're just a work-for-hire type of person, you know, they'll do it, but they won't be passionate about it. They'll just say, okay,
right,
tell me what to do, and no interest. So it's nice if you could find people, and that's the difficult part. I haven't really mastered this, finding people with like passions, and then you could really brainstorm, and if you're looking at something from one angle, they could really be helpful and say, hey, you're missing this, or wouldn't it be great if we could try this? And I think that's where you really get your best out of a team.
Tell me about the team that you had for this. Did you have a camera person that helped you out with filming? And
anybody else helped
you with projects?
You know, my sort of the director of photography, he was based in New York, and he did most of the filming with the interviews, except I had to, when I was at, had the out-of-town interviews, I had to get local people from those cities. But he was able to fuse that all together, and also I used the same person I used did the majority of the editing as well. So did a really nice job. I was very pleased with that. But again, you know, it's someone you just it's someone for hire and working on several different projects, and they have to pay the rent and put food in their bellies. And so, you know, while I'm paying them a salary for their work, they are also working elsewhere.
Yeah. What was his name?
Steve DeCasa.
Steve
DeCasa,
okay.
And really, really, really talented individual.
Okay. I know the film was shown at Doc Miami, as part of Doc Miami, when they were here in Boca at the Sugar Sand Park, which is where I saw it.
Right, that's
tell
where
me
we
about
met.
How you got in there. I'm sorry?
Well, that's the next thing. You finish your film. What do you do next? How are you going to market it? So I guess a familiar route for a lot of filmmakers is trying the film festival circuit. And that's what I did. I entered it into various film festivals. You don't get accepted in all of them, but it depends on who's reviewing the film and who find and what their criteria is, and there's no way to really know that. So it's sort of a crapshoot when it comes to that. But Doc Miami, specializing in documentary films, they accepted a film, and that's and it was screened there and very well accepted. So so I was very pleased. And Monica Rosales, who is the director of the film festival, is very, very supportive of local filmmakers in general and a big supporter of the arts overall. So she's been very very helpful to trying to help get my film really some exposure.
And you had a showing, was it yesterday that you had the showing in Boca?
Oh, Friday. It was canceled because it was scheduled for outdoors. And it was part of,
it was supposed to be
in Boca Raton at the shops at the Boca Center. It was going to be in the courtyard. But I think it's part of, it was the Boca Chamber of Commerce Festival Days. But that is rescheduled. It's a free event unless, I mean, they charge,
okay.
I mean, it's you know, sort of a benefit. And there, you know, they ask, you know, if you want to give a donation, great. Otherwise, it's free. And VIP seating, I think they charge $5. But they're rescheduling that for September 5th at 8 p.m., and that's on a Friday evening. So I will be there for that.
Okay, September 5th at 8 p.m. at the shops at Boca Raton.
Right.
Right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Yeah, so I was thinking, oh, geez, I missed that. So I was going to come out, and then
now I can go. Now you have a few weeks, and you can get another picture. We can get another picture together.
Yeah, there we go. Oh, is it showing anywhere else coming up?
Not immediately, no.
Okay.
It's very limited at this point. However, there are a few things, and here's another thing I'll lead into, where as a film that you're doing yourself, you're financing yourself, and you're passionate about, it's not just something you just say, okay, I'm done, goodbye, after it's completed. When you get additional, something usually comes up that you say, oh, gee, I wish I would have done this, and I wish I could have found this, that at the time. And I'm the type of person where if something does come up that I feel is valuable to include, I'm not afraid to re-edit. And that's pretty much what happened very recently. An example, about a year ago, the film was being screened, and a woman in the audience introduced herself to me as the daughter of someone named Mimi Serenetti. And in 1930, Mimi Serenetti was this 11-year-old girl who walked into a bank in Brooklyn while Willie Sutton and accomplice were robbing the place. Well, this 11-year-old girl ran out screaming, and Willie Sutton and his accomplice, they just dropped everything and left empty-handed. So this 11-year-old girl foiled a Willie Sutton robbery. Mm-hmm. And in my prior research, I was unable to find any information about what happened to Mimi Serenetti. I looked everywhere, and I figured, okay, 11 years old in 1930, she's, probably deceased by now. Mm-hmm. Well, this woman who claimed Mimi was her mother told me Mimi's alive, kicking, and really remembers all these events, and she's 94 years old, living in Florida.
Wow.
And at that point, I just said, wow. I was amazed. I said, I just knew I had to go visit Mimi and film an interview. So the film's been out already for over a year, and I just said, that's it. I'm going to interview her. I filmed an interview. It was great. She told a terrific story. And now I'm looking for a local editor that wants a day's work.
Okay. So how do people contact you if they want to get involved?
Come to me, there's the website, which is www.willysutton.com, and it has all my contact information and email address.
Okay, great.
And,
And, well, we're running out of time.
What I'm looking to do, I love working on projects. I love working with people, like bouncing off ideas. People are always coming to me with ideas, and I always, I'll always listen to people. I won't necessarily say, I'll work on it, but I'll listen to someone. I'll give you my feedback. Like I said, if someone's going to say, wow, I'd like to do a project on alligators in the Everglades, I'll say, great, I'm not your person because I don't know anything about it. I don't have any interest on that, but I'll steer them in the right direction.
Well, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but, next project, let me know, and I'll bring you back, and we'll talk some more.
Certainly. That's great.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll get to see you on the 5th. Hopefully I can come out and see you again, and just keep me posted on what's up for next, what's next, okay?
Sure thing. Thank you for having me on, Rachel. Really appreciate
it.
It's been fun, and I always like talking about the project, especially an interesting, colorful character like Willie Sutton.
Well, thank you, Rich, and I will talk to you soon.
You got it. Thanks again, Rachel. Have a good afternoon.
Right. Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye. Okay, well, that was a great conversation with Rich Gold, and like he said, he has an upcoming showing on September 5th at 8 p.m. at the Shops at Boca Raton, which you can Google that. I don't have the address handy, sorry, but check that out if you are local. You can see the film. It's a great documentary. If you're into history at all or true crime, it's definitely up your alley and you want to take a look at it. Like I mentioned earlier, I don't know, I had a little bit of a technical difficulty, I think, earlier. I have to go back and listen and see what happened, but you might have missed it. But I was talking about that I have archives, of course, here on the show that I've interviewed over 100 people, and you can go back and listen to all of those archives and see who I've had on the show. And if you are a filmmaker out there and you'd like to be on the show, please contact me. My email address is ravenprods@yahoo.com. That's ravenprods@yahoo.com. And in addition, I have my Independent Streak magazine, which features local filmmakers and filmmakers around the world and tidbits of information on filmmaking and all kinds of fun stuff. So you want to check that out, and you have you can see all of the magazines posted on my website, which is www.independentstreakmagazine.com. Please take a look at that. And in addition, I have a Facebook site, which is www.facebook.com/IndieStreak, just like this show. Please like the page, because I do put information not only about this radio show, but also local castings, sometimes international castings, all kinds of different stuff I put up there about the film industry specifically. I don't put anything other than film information. So if you are into film, and you probably are if you're listening to this show, then you want to like that page, Indie Streak. Okay, and I will be back next week with someone new, so please join us next week, same time, same channel. All right, thanks, guys. Bye-bye.